The Bloodstream Podcast is made possible through the generous support of Shire. And for that, we say...
Thank you, Shire.
Thanks, Shire.
Do you think other animals feel insecure about their bodies?
That is a great question. I don't know. I don't think so. Right?
I mean, yeah, I but like primates, for instance. Like,
yeah, but you go to a zoo and they all just look fat and don't care. Like, that's the ultimate, like, you know, no things given.
Yeah, but like, are they secretly being like, man, I gotta like...
I don't think they got secrets like that. No, they don't seem... I feel like primates are pretty straightforward. The non-human kinds.
Yeah, but I've seen like monkeys like looking at their bellies and touching their bellies and...
I think they like exploring. I mean, they throw poop too. Like they do some, you know, touching of body stuff, but I don't think they're like, oh, Melinda's really going to give me grief about my gut. I don't think that's happening.
I'm curious.
All right, well, we'll look into it, I guess. Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 15, August 21st, 2017. I am your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, we preview National Hemophilia Foundation's annual meeting with soundbites from CEO Val Bias and NHF staff and volunteers in a special annual meeting 2017 interview segment. During our like, share, comment segment, Natalie and I discuss a recent CNBC article on companies with particularly strong health insurance packages, a World Federation of Hemophilia article on their twinning program's 2016 success stories, and you'll hear directly from community member Tayan Chow Kudu, who shares her story of managing severe hemophilia A in a piece she's titled Hemophilia Not Just Physical. All of that, plus the latest on a new inquiry into the contaminated blood scandal in the UK, coming up on episode 15 of the Bloodstream Podcast. Welcome to Bloodstream. Natalie, it's August already. How did that happen?
I don't know. The summer's gone by very quickly.
I think it's so easy to say that, but I do feel like August is the month of the year that it's the most legitimate. Like, I can't believe it's this month already, because it's the end of such a thing and it's the beginning of another thing.
Yeah, it's always like, oh man. Yeah. Summer's over.
There's always a little...
I mean, it's not over yet, but well, and September's the best month anyway, so it is sad to see summer go, but like, September's real nice.
You're super biased because that's your birthday month, and yeah. I know that because I know that about my wife. That seems like
good,
a thing
good.
I should know. So
no,
I think
but it's
you're
just
a little
like also really beautiful.
Yeah, that's true too. That is true too. Well, yes, it is August, and actually earlier this month, just to kick off our housekeeping for episode 15 here, Bloodstream and Believe Limited were in Texas for the Texas Bleeding Disorders Conference, and I want to give a big thank you to Melissa Compton, the Lone Star Chapter, and the Texas Bleeding Disorders Conference for enabling Bloodstream Media to debut our booth. Went really well, got to interact with a lot of community members, and learned that we need to keep doing education on podcasts. Number one question that we got at the booth is, what is a podcast? A lot of people came by who did know about the podcast and were excited to say hello, grab a sticker, ask a question for Ask the Expert, but there were also a lot of people who were just unfamiliar with podcasts in general. So that leads me to think that we need to do a little more education on our end to make sure that we're educating our community on the value of podcasts, how they're kind of like having talk radio in a Netflix when you want it, as you want it style, and on any topic under the sun, anything at all that interests you. If you're listening, obviously you've found podcasts, well done you. Tell people about them and tell people where they can find them, because I think people get intimidated by this idea of a podcast because
it's
a word they're not used to.
It's not only telling people, but it's actually showing them.
Yeah.
Like when for Bloodstream, you know, my mom and dad wanted to listen to it. So I literally like went on my mom's phone and I was like, you have a podcast app and it's this purple one.
Right.
And this is how you open it and this is how you subscribe. And I subscribed her. And so like they listened to us.
Yeah.
Hi, mom.
Yeah. Hey, how's it going, Mama Ruth Ann? Yeah, that's true. Take the couple minutes to actually like walk somebody through.
Yeah,
so
because it's intimidating to like kind of set up a new media for yourself.
Sure.
And you know, and then once you see that it's super easy and right there and it's on your phone, you can listen to it when you're commuting, you can listen to it when you're cleaning your bathroom. Like it's a really nice thing to just have on in the background during those times where you can just like listen or, you know,
yeah,
have
we
something
have
on.
Well, at least, you know, I have one on almost all the time.
Patrick has a podcast addiction.
I do. I do. But she loves me anyway.
But yeah, so educate.
And speaking of podcasts, I want to give a couple heads ups about some episodes of our other podcast series that you might enjoy. Ask the Expert. Ha 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 ha. Ask the Expert, which I am not at speaking. Episode 6, which comes out later this month, Monday, August 28th, features Carrie Koenig, who is, in addition to being a community mom and a school teacher with 10 years experience, She is also HFA's Family Programs Manager, and she came on to talk about HFA's Back to School Toolkit, a really comprehensive toolkit to help you prepare for going back to school, and answer questions from me and from community members on how do you prep school administrators, teachers, coaches, your kid, and your family for getting back to school. So that'll be coming out at the end of the month. Very good episode, so keep an eye out for that on the Ask the Expert podcast series. Powering Through podcast, episode 7, came out earlier this summer, and I highly recommend it. It features four hemophilia treatment center hematologists from the Southern California area. It was part of a panel that was put together for the Hemophilia Foundation of Southern California's Education Day. And the four HTC docs talk about women with bleeding disorders, insurance challenges, chronic pain management, aging with hemophilia, the challenge of treating a multicultural community, updates on treatment products for patients with inhibitors, tracking and understanding quality of life, and on and on and on and on. Childhood obesity, a lot of topics from these four expert hematologists. So I highly recommend Powering Through Pod Episode 7. You can find the links at bloodstreammedia.com, or you can follow the links in the program notes. The World Federation of Hemophilia's Humanitarian Aid Program released the Outreach and Identification in Indonesia video that Believe Limited produced, directed, and edited for them. You might remember that trip. We were talking about it only a couple months ago. Really proud of that video. It's about 6 minutes long and includes some great windows into what is being done in Indonesia to help on a clinical side of things, expand the amount of outreach and identification of potential patients, and on the patient side of things, what they are doing to help raise awareness and raise conversations about bleeding disorders. And there's some really touching moments. One in particular that I like involves a mother and a son and some lovely sharing. If you have a mother or a son, you might emotionally connect with it and find the video really valuable. I don't know. Follow the links in the program notes. You can make up your own mind. And two last things. Believe has a number of responsibilities at annual meeting this year. So we decided to create a little two-minute video that kind of breaks down the Teen Impact Awards presentation on the making of Bombardier Blood, where we'll be premiering a making of Bombardier Blood video, behind the scenes video, our involvement with Shire's Celebration of Firsts in VWD Symposium, Powering Through, the Bloodstream Media booth, Natalie's teaching two yoga classes, and on and on and on. So if you, again, follow the links in the program notes, or you can go to believeltd.com/NHF2017, where there is both a video, about 2 minutes long, and a written outline of our agenda in particular. Annual meeting is a busy time, so we wanted to give you the best tool possible to understand at least what Believe and Bloodstream are up to, if that is of interest to you. And lastly, but not leastly, something we've been working on for a while, and I could finally start talking about, Bloodstream Media and the Bloodstream Podcast specifically have been developing a three-part podcast series on factor product development and the history of it in our community. It's going to be about a 90-minute series all told, three 30-minute episodes, give or take, and coming out in October. So we've wrapped up most of the interviews that we're going to be doing for that. It's also a collaboration with the National Hemophilia Foundation, the AIDS Memorial Grove, the HIV Story Project, Marilyn Ness and Bad Blood. So we have a lot of other entities that are contributing to this, which is amazing. And it's really cool. We've had a couple of researchers and writers working on it now under Ryan Geelan, the co-founder of Believe Limited, and I, for the last like 3 months. And I think it's in really great shape. So still a lot of work to be done, but I think we're going to come up with a really cool, unique resource. And again, that'll be coming out in October. So in addition to this, the traditional monthly episode of the Bloodstream Podcast, there'll be three other Bloodstream Podcast episodes popping up in your podcast player of choice come October. So there'll be more on that probably next month. We'll have more details by the time the September episode of this is ready. But I just wanted to share that because, yeah, now it's only 2 months away from being released. Wah, 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 wah. Sometimes I make funny faces or funny sounds just to make sure Natalie's still alive when I ramble on and on for a long period of time.
He saw my eyes glazing over.
I did. So I had to bring you back in. All right. Well, that does it for all the housekeeping, the promo stuff. Again, everything I'm talking about is in the program notes. So if you're intrigued by any of that, check the program notes, click the links, and take a look at the content. And with that, let's move on to like, share, comment.
All right. So for the like of the like, share, comment segment.
That's right. The like section of the like, share, comment segment.
Thank you. He loves to correct me. Anyways, it's
I wish they could have seen your expression. Go ahead.
9 companies hiring now that cover 100% of employee health insurance premiums, which is pretty awesome.
So I have to admit, I have not really had normal jobs in my life. I didn't realize that companies covering any amount of your insurance premiums was a thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when you hear of someone who has a job where they pay zero premiums and have a very low or zero deductible, like that's better than being like, oh, I make 6 figures. Like,
right.
The overall compensation value, yeah, package and value is amazing. And since 2001, the number of employers on Fortune's 100 best companies to work for list who provide full health coverage to its employees have dropped from 34% to just 9% in 2016.
Huge drop.
Yeah. So like these jobs are rare, or these companies who offer these benefits are rare.
Another thing, speaking of kind of stats from the article, something that jumped out to me too, 155 million Americans are either dependent on their employer or a family member's employer for their health insurance.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. I mean, that's almost half the country as well. And yeah, only 9% offer total coverage of premiums.
Well, and then other companies do offer, you know, you don't necessarily, when you're looking for a job, look into the whole, it's like, oh, they have healthcare, great. But then you get in and your premiums are hundreds of dollars every month, and then you have a $2,000 deductible. So it's like, okay, well, like at the end of the year, just for basic care, I'm spending thousands of dollars. Thanks, company.
Yeah.
Like who said like, yeah, we have health benefits.
Right. So, what does it actually mean? What does it actually translate as?
Yeah, Glassdoor, which is a job search platform, one that I actually used when I was looking for jobs, mm-hmm, compiled a list of companies hiring right now who cover 100% of employee health insurance premiums. And the ones on this list, the 9 of them actually offer, some of them offer much, much more too.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting. Like some of them, I know you're going to run down the list of names in a second, but like one of the companies, not only do they cover 100% of, your, health insurance, but any dependents as well. That seems to be a variable with this short list, is some cover up to half of the dependents, some don't cover dependents, some 100%. So
yeah,
it's kind of like what you were just saying too. Oh, we offer health benefits. You know, what does that actually mean? What does that actually translate as? You gotta read the fine print, so to speak. But do you want to just run down that list for us?
Sure. Number 9 is a company called FactSet. 8 are Threx. 7, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. 6, GoDaddy. 5, the Boston Consulting Group. 4, Twitter. 3, Ultimate Software. 2, ZocDoc. And 1 is the Kimley Horn and Associates. And also Glassdoor itself also qualifies for this list.
So actually, let's stay on that track. So Glassdoor, you were mentioning earlier using it and how, you know, there's kind of a conventional way to think about your professional working life and occupation, but maybe thinking more about the company itself, their culture, what the company's about. Just share a little bit of what you were talking to me about off mic.
Yeah, so I think it's important, you know, I think when we are in high school or college or meet with a job counselor, mm-hmm, that it's like, oh, well, what kind of job do you want? And I think it's far more important to think about what kind of company, what kind of organization you want to work for, you know, what they offer, what the health, you know, the salary, the total compensation package, salary, health benefits, 401k, growth opportunities within that company, because then you can come in at an entry-level job or a job that maybe isn't your dream job, but know that, like, within that company, there's movement,
right,
and that, you know, your quality of life or your life outside of work is taken care of very well. And, you know, you were saying, like, as someone with a chronic disorder growing up.
Yeah. Just drilled into your head, like, you know, you can never be without health insurance. You can never be without health insurance. And with the Affordable Care Act enabling single payer and the fact that I can get mine as I do through the exchange just as an individual, that's great. It's still...
But for many, cost prohibitive.
It's not cheap. Yeah, I think if I'm a young person in high school or college starting to think about what I want to do professionally, I like the fact that a place like Glassdoor is helping you aggregate this kind of information so that you can refine your quote-unquote job search in such a way that, as you just said, you can learn more about the company and the options and opportunities within that company, learn about what they offer you, what is that total compensation package, and what does that look like, and maybe use that as a means to thinking about what you want to specifically position yourself as rather than choosing the occupation and then seeking a company.
I think it's important to think about like what you want your life to look like. You know, I don't want to have to worry about health. I don't have to worry about my health care. I don't have to worry about the costs associated with that. Like if that is one of your top priorities, it doesn't matter what job you do, knowing that that is taken care of will just make your life feel better. I mean, I'm a part-time flight attendant, and that job itself isn't my dream job, but the life that it allows me, the flexibility that it allows me to do other things, makes that job my dream job.
Links to the article and links as well to the Glassdoor. I guess they have an app and they have a web platform. But yeah, if you're curious, links in the program notes for that. And now for the share section of the like, share, comment segment for episode 15. And it comes from Tayan Chowkudu. Tayan is unusual in that she is a female who has severe hemophilia A. And she has written a piece on the connection between hemophilia and mental and emotional health. And she's titled it Hemophilia, Not Just Physical. She has written and recorded that piece for the podcast, and we will play that now. And then Natalie and I will be back on the other side with some reflections on it. So here it is.
Hi, my name is Tayan Chowkudu. I'm 18 years old and live with severe hemophilia A. This October, I'm starting school to become a craniosacral practitioner. Craniosacral is a healing modality which allows your nervous system to switch from sympathetic, also known as fight or flight, to parasympathetic, known as rest and digest. In our modern world, many people are overworked and stressed out, so their body cannot reset in its much-needed parasympathetic state. Damage from the stress can store in the tissues of your body for days, months, and even decades. The body is amazing at healing itself if given the right time and space in a state of parasympathetic relaxation. Craniosacral work is amazing, and I believe it has the power to help people heal. I've always had a desire to help people heal, and I believe that it stems from growing up with hemophilia. Ever since I was diagnosed at age 3, I've been involved in the hemophilia community of New York. At age 6, I started attending hemophilia summer camps upstate. These camps were free and helped balance out the pain and discomfort of having hemophilia with the joy of new friendships and meaningful connections. I remember walking into my cabin that first year, my new home for the week. I was nervous. As I unpacked my bag, I found a post-it note stuck to my bed. It read, "Do you want to be my friend?" It was written by another camper who turned out to be the only other girl there with hemophilia. We became camp buddies and were able to confide in each other and share joyful experiences. That moment obviously touched me and has stuck with me, an early experience of the power of kindness. For some reason, the kids at my school were not so open and kind. They would often tease other students who were noticeably different, for example, students who were extremely overweight or had learning disabilities. They would frequently make fun of our teachers, even to their faces. Throughout school, it was difficult for me to connect to and relate with my classmates. I even went through phases of deep depression. Thankfully, I continued to attend hemophilia summer camp and came to believe that kids with chronic conditions tended to have a greater maturity and sensitivity. Perhaps it was coming face to face with our own mortality, as well as deeper existential questions, that triggered this compassion and wisdom within. Although the connection between hemophilia and emotional and mental health is very much unaddressed, I, speaking as a hemophiliac, can tell you that it is not just a physical condition. I believe kids with hemophilia, or really any chronic condition, are more apt to experience life from a perspective which considers the pain and suffering of other people. Therefore, opportunities to take a nurturing role and help relieve the suffering of others are essential. Even for very young kids, there are countless ways to exercise this empathetic nature. Try taking your young hemophiliac to volunteer at an organization called Brown Paper Bag, which feeds homeless people in Manhattan and the Bay Area, or volunteer at an elderly home. I can now clearly see that the compassion and sensitivity we develop early on is a blessing rather than a curse. We may struggle because of how differently we feel from other kids, but we will often be the ones caring for the downtrodden members of society, understanding the deepest wounds in our friends and family, and ultimately displaying one of the most beautiful human qualities, tenderness in the face of suffering. Hemophilia is truly a blessing.
All right, Natalie, what did you think of that?
Well, I mean...
You were smiling the entire time and staring at me.
Well, yeah, just first of all, craniosacral work and yoga training. I mean, this is my world. Like, mm-hmm. all that work and physical manipulation and movement and finding ways to get yourself back into your parasympathetic nervous system, because you can't heal when your body is in fight or flight. Like, healing cannot occur.
Mm-hmm.
And our modern society is keeping us so much more in our sympathetic nervous system than our parasympathetic nervous system. And so people are living with trauma unhealed for a long time. And it's becoming, I think, very apparent in society at large.
Mm. So, Yeah, no, that's something that you and I have talked about more and more the last several months, is my awareness of that work and the value of slowing down and resting, meditating, addressing trauma. It seemed quite timely when Tayan first shared this piece with me, and then, you know, I asked her if we could do it here for the podcast, and I'm thankful she said yes. But it was an interesting kind of life intersection when she had the inspiration to share that with me. And it happened to be about something that you and I are talking about very frequently. And I was enthusiastically supportive of the work she was doing and her passion for it. And I have to say, and I'm biased, obviously, I kind of agree with her position that growing up with a chronic condition does lead you to have more understanding for the pain and suffering of others. I do think there's something to that. And
absolutely. Well, last weekend I was at a wedding and I ran into an old friend of mine. And she's dating someone new, and the woman she's dating has spina bifida. And we were just talking about being with partners who were children with a chronic condition,
mm-hmm.
and how we both find our partners to be very kind human beings and able to tap into empathy in this very, like, profound way. So just hearing that now too, like, brought me back to my conversation with an old friend, and just talking about, like, you know, being with someone, having a partner who grew up that way, and how that formed who they became as an adult.
Thank you, Tayan, for contributing that piece. Continue on this awesome path that you're on of becoming a healer and paying attention to areas of need and treatment that are, as you mentioned, unaddressed or under-addressed. If you want to read Tayan's piece, there is also a text version. You can follow the links in the program notes and find it on the Bloodstream blog. Now for the comment section of the Like, Share, Comment segment for episode 15, I want to highlight two articles that came out recently from the World Federation of Hemophilia, just to put a little bit of a global perspective on things. The first is the 2016 Twins of the Year Help Make a Difference article. So, quick background, the WFH, one of the many programs that it facilitates is their twinning program, which is an establishing of partnerships aimed at improving hemophilia care in emerging countries. There have been, in the 20 years of this program, there have been 215 partnerships established across 113 countries. And again, the goal being that the twinned organizations, or the twinned hemophilia treatment centers, work together and share information, resulting in a mutually beneficial partnership to transfer expertise and experience, et cetera, et cetera. So the 2016 Twins of the Year were the Hemophilia Foundation of Uganda and the London, UK Hemophilia Treatment Center. And their four-year twinning experience resulted in some successes listed here in this article, including conducting medical workshops to train healthcare workers, village health team workers, and laboratory technicians, diagnosing new patients with bleeding disorders, conducting outreach campaigns to educate people about bleeding disorders, and raising awareness of bleeding disorders through media coverage and TV broadcasts. If you'd like to learn more about the twinning program, take a look at some of the history, and maybe even inquire as to whether your chapter or treatment center could be involved in twinning, follow the links in the program notes, or you can visit wfh.org/twins. And the second piece to our two-part comment section of the Like, Share, Comment segment is on a WFH article titled Inquiry to Investigate Contaminated Blood Scandal in UK. So, real brief background. while the legal actions that resulted from the blood contamination crisis here in the U.S. have taken place, and for all intents and purposes, it is a closed case, not to say it's resolved or everyone is healed or anything like that, but in a big picture way, it's a closed case. That's not the case in the U.K. There have been other inquiries. There is now a new inquiry. So I'm going to read this article from the WFH, and then I also had somebody from the Hemophilia Society in the UK, James Hunt, their head of fundraising, point me toward their most recent statements as well. So I'm just going to share with you kind of what's going on with regard to this inquiry in the UK. The government of the United Kingdom has announced that a new inquiry will be held to investigate the contaminated blood scandal that occurred primarily in the 1970s and 80s. This resulted in approximately 7,500 people being infected with hepatitis C and HIV and other blood-borne viruses, causing over 2,400 deaths. As patients with hemophilia and other bleeding disorders during that period regularly used treatment products made from donated blood, the bleeding disorders community was particularly strongly affected by the tragedy. There have been two previous inquiries, the Archer Report in 2007 and another, the Penrose Inquiry in Scotland in 2015, but members of the British Parliament and patient advocates have asserted that a new inquiry was needed because the previous ones had not gone into sufficient depth on the issue, had not compelled witnesses from government, and had not delivered justice to victims. As blood was not screened for viruses in the UK prior to 1990, many people who received donated blood or blood products in the 70s and 80s were infected with hepatitis and HIV and other infections. This tragedy had many causes, including the fact that the UK imported donated blood from the United States, which was often provided by high-risk individuals, such as prison inmates selling their blood. The fact that the community was not made adequately aware of the situation, and those infected with a virus were not always informed of their condition for many months or years, along with a general lack of transparency, have led many to believe that there was some kind of cover-up involved. Theresa May, the current British Prime Minister, has called the contaminated blood scandal, quote, an appalling tragedy which should simply never have happened. The inquiry will look into the causes of the scandal and will determine what further actions to take. The exact nature of how the inquiry will be held and whether it could lead to prosecutions is to be determined. People affected by the scandal have received some monetary support, but no compensation. There has been no admission of liability by any organization. Many are remarking that the 30-year delay is much too long given the severity of the event, and given the fact that inquiries were completed in several other countries more than a decade ago. Former UK Secretary of State for Health Andy Burnham, who championed the campaign for an inquiry, said the announcement was a long overdue, quote, major breakthrough, quote, for those affected by the scandal. Liz Carroll, the chief executive of the Hemophilia Society, said, quote, for decades, people with bleeding disorders and their families have sought the truth. Instead, they were told by the government that no mistakes were made, while it repeatedly refused to acknowledge evidence of negligence and a subsequent cover-up. Finally, they will have the chance to see justice. However, the inquiry must not be led by the Department of Health as proposed. I call on you, the Prime Minister, to ensure this inquiry is passed to another department. That's the end of the article, and there's some sources cited, including the BBC, The Telegraph, and The Independent, so it's a well-sourced article. The statement that the Hemophilia Society individual pointed me to is essentially kind of reconfirms what is stated in this WFH article here, and there's some more granular information about some of the logistics and some of the specific asks with regard to this inquiry. But that's kind of the latest. It seems as though there'll be more information sooner than not about some of the makeup, and if it isn't going to be an inquiry that is handled by the Department of Health, who will it be led by? That seems to be a big TBD. Perhaps by the time this comes out, this might already be old news. I don't know how quickly this story will be developing, but I think it's something that's interesting for us to keep an eye on, and just because it doesn't necessarily affect us directly here in the U.S., obviously the contamination crisis was not something that exclusively affected Americans, so it is nice to hear that progress is being made for the families in the UK who were affected, that were one step closer to having a more thorough investigation that results in actual accountability for what the Prime Minister referred to as, what did she say, an appalling tragedy which simply never should have happened. So that's that. That's the latest on the inquiry to investigate the contaminated blood scandal in UK, and that will conclude this month's Like, Share, Comment segment. In just a moment, we'll hear our NHF annual meeting preview interview segment for the month, featuring sound bites from NHF CEO Val Bias, as well as numerous other staff members and volunteers. But first, just want to say once again, a big thank you to Shire for making the Bloodstream podcast possible. We appreciate Shire's support of our new media way of educating, empowering, and engaging with the bleeding disorders community. So I want to give a big thanks to Shire for making this thing possible.
Thanks, Shire.
All right, and now to the interview segment. Hope you enjoy. And don't forget, after this, if you want to see what NHF is, what Believe is up to at NHF's annual meeting 2017, check out the program notes for a link to our Believe at NHF 2017 video and schedule.
Hi, my name is Matthew Delaney. I'm a community member and volunteer at the National Hemophilia Foundation, and I helped create the Youth and Young Adult track this year at the annual meeting in Chicago. So this year, what we've been really putting an emphasis on is advocacy, talking to people throughout the community and people that I've met at annual meetings, that I've met through my time in NYLI at various places around the country. It's more important than ever to be not only a self-advocate and an advocate for the community, especially in today's, you know, political climate and today's climate, just as a person with a bleeding disorder. So I think that was one of the main focuses that I wanted to put on the youth advocacy track, and also at the youth sessions at annual meeting this year. The number one thing I think for teens and young adults is that they think they don't have a say, especially in this community where a lot of people are, you know, middle age or older. A lot of people think, well, because of our past in the hemophilia community, that, you know, it's not necessarily that much of an issue anymore. And I don't think that's true. And I think that can be very discouraging for a lot of youth and young adults. So I think that's something I was really trying to push this year at annual meeting, especially for our young people, to really get out there, really get involved. And whether you're doing your own thing within your community or you're working with NHF, I think us facilitating young people to get out there in the community is of utmost importance. The tracks this year, there's ones talking about, you know, what's my normal? So breaking into boys and girls groups, talking about masculinity and femininity, growing up with bleeding disorders. There's things about prophy adherence. There's things about going off to college with a bleeding disorder, going to trade school, even just living on your own. Because we want to make sure we encompass everyone, but we want to have people who are just branching out as adults, going from a child with a bleeding disorder to an adult with a bleeding disorder. From diagnosis isn't destiny, don't tell me what to do. That's another session that we're doing. And that's about people who necessarily haven't followed proper treatment, or people who said, you know, this isn't really a big deal, and then it comes back and tries to get them later in life. And so I think that's important, because the main thing that I hear with teens is, oh, this doesn't really matter. Like, everything's fine. A bleeding disorder isn't that big of a deal. Well, we're trying to say, with proper adherence to treatment and proper adherence to a healthy lifestyle, it doesn't have to be a big deal. This community has helped so many people, including myself. Even as someone, you know, 2-3 years ago, I wasn't that involved in the community whatsoever. And I think something that really has kept me going and has made me more passionate than ever is the way this community embraces everybody. And I think we want to show the teens this year that it's good to be involved, and not only will you be accepted, you'll be celebrated. Last year, I was really amazed at how many sessions there were for VWD. I spoke on a few panels about being a man with VWD, which is an interesting experience, because it's seen as more of a women's disease, which is not true, because just as many men than women have VWD. It's just diagnosed more in women. So I would say, I mean, NHF's one of their mottos is for all bleeding disorders. And I think that really is conveyed well at annual meeting. And I think that's something that everyone's trying to convey more, that this is for all bleeding disorders. I really want to make these things more interactive for the teen track. Because if you're just being lectured at, why would you travel all the way to Chicago just to hear a talk that, you know, is live streamed online?
I'm attending because it was a real impact to see the community on a national level. It really puts a new perspective on it to see the big picture. What I would press on a new parent or any new member of this community is that for me, it really was about learning from the people who had gone through it. It calmed me down. It made me feel like it was not impossible. You know, at first when you hear about brain bleeds and spontaneous bleeds and you think about having to access veins, and it's alarming. Those are not normal things, you know, that people like me grew up with. So the learning curve was dramatic. And I think that it gave me a real sense of peace knowing that you learn to grow into this role and it becomes normal for you. And it's not as scary, you know, once you see other people doing it. I remember first walking into one of the local meetings where it was a mom on mom group where we all sat and talked about our mom issues, and there was a lot of crying. And the first thing I asked this group of women was, when will I ever stop feeling panicked? Am I ever going to stop feeling like this sense of urgency around my son and protecting him in a way that was different than I was used to with my other children? They really calmed me down. It was such a good feeling to see, look, we are all good. We all have these hard times in this disorder, but it is completely manageable. And with the support of your peers, you take a lot of reassurance from knowing that you're not the only one having these obstacles. Sometimes you really need somebody to just tell you that it's going to be okay. It feels horrible right now, but it's going to be okay. Sierra, she's watched this evolution of Shane's bleeding disorder. She also was a lot like me, very fearful of not only needles, but just the doctor in general. She has, over the course of these last 4 years, become Shane's, I would say, his biggest supporter. She's at all of his IV infusions. She is there. And she attends a lot of local functions year-round. So for me, I'm excited for her to come this year to get a glimpse of it on this national scale, because like I said, it really does give you a sense of the community on a national scale. And my hope is that she'll come away with more perspective and with tools that will not only empower her as her brother's advocate, but that inspire her and encourage her to use her voice in all areas of life. I remember last year being at NHF for the first time and just really being blown away by not only how many people that I recognized locally, but how many people were there. But also I think that it'll be helpful to maybe commiserate on some of the downsides of it. Maybe there's some resentment. Maybe I know Sierra sometimes expresses to me that, oh my gosh, all we do is hemophilia. And I feel like when she's able to communicate that with other siblings, it's helpful to her. She feels like, okay, so I'm not the only one. We're all kind of in this together. And this is going to be a really special experience for her in that she'll just get to broaden her horizon, get to see how other families are dealing with hemophilia and meet other kids that are in her same position. I think it's just going to be such a great experience for her.
Hi, I'm Susan Hartman, and I'm a member of the annual meeting planning committee for the National Hemophilia Foundation. It's my third year on the planning committee, and I'm the spouse of a man with factor VIII deficiency, severe hemophilia. I think I've attended annual meeting, I don't know, maybe 6 times, in a few different capacities. We originally presented at I don't even remember what year it was. It was in New Orleans. We actually sat on a panel with a few other couples to discuss conception options for HIV serodiscordant couples. My husband also has HIV, and we were looking at different ways to try to safely have a child. And at that time, we already had one. So we were sharing our journey with other couples at that time. So it's actually a whole committee of people who get together once a year or twice a year to plan the annual meeting. And some of the folks on the committee do work for NHF in the New York or other field offices. Many of us, however, are members of the community, and some are chapter members, some are social workers. I'm just a regular old person. And we're there generally representing different segments of the community. So looking at different topics that we think would be interesting for conference goers to talk about while they're at the annual meeting. I'm in charge of the spouse partner track, and this is our third year with this track, and it's actually really growing. We're a full track this year. I think we have 7 sessions, including 2 workshop sessions that are by design 2 hours each and really intended to be more interactive and more exciting for participants to get involved. And the spouse partner track, I think, is really only 3 years old. I kept going to annual meetings, and after a couple of times, there really wasn't anything for me to talk about as a spouse or a partner. I didn't have a child with hemophilia. It didn't run in our family. We weren't struggling with any hemophilia-related issues, really. My husband's hemophilia is under control, and he manages his healthcare. And I would sometimes go to annual meetings, and I would leave halfway through and go shopping. Isn't that horrible? I would go shopping. I know, and I was like, this is ridiculous. So I complained a lot about how I thought that as spouses and partners, particularly those of us who've been in the community for quite a while, it'd be really great to really have a track that could address our needs as members of the community. I think we're often kind of forgotten in the community a little bit. So we started the spouse partner track, and it's really grown. We've had a lot of fantastic feedback. I think spouses and partners, they want to be heard. We want to feel heard, and that we're important to the community, that our role is integral to the health and well-being of our spouses and the people that we're partners with. One of the most regular pieces of feedback we get is that there's a need for couples retreats. We're trying to provide opportunities for those attending the annual meeting to tap into some of those workshop type activities that you would find at, say, maybe a more traditional sort of couples retreat. And I think that's the key is, and we say spouses and partners, we're really, it's an inclusive group of people. I think traditionally we would think of the wives of men with hemophilia, and that's not at all what this track is. It's for those individuals who are in long-term committed relationship with individuals who have a bleeding disorder. And that's heterosexual couples, same-sex couples. It's really a wide open conversation, really looking at the couple's connection that's different than being the mom or a parent to a kid with hemophilia or being a nurse.
Our mission at the annual meeting is to provide up-to-date information, educational initiatives, and science as it relates to research going forward for the community. You know, a lot of things happen at the meeting, but it really is about information, education, and science at the meeting. That is aimed at not only consumers who attend the meeting, but chapter organizations who attend the meeting. As you probably know, we have a day and a half of chapter workshops to help them run more effective or diverse local activities for people that they serve. In addition, we have a provider track, and by provider, I mean clinicians who work at HTCs that include physician workshops, nursing, social work, and physical therapy. All of those workshops are supported with CEU units so that they can maintain their credentials as professionals in the clinical field serving the bleeding disorders community. Now, that's a real important aspect. Of course, we also have our medical and scientific advisory committee meeting scheduled on Saturday at the annual meeting, which is pretty much a full day activity, but a great opportunity for people to sit in for a little while and hear what the best clinicians and researchers in the field of bleeding disorder are discussing and debating on behalf of people with bleeding disorders to come up with recommendations that enhance the quality of life of patients who live with bleeding disorders. So that's the reason and the mission of the meeting. Secondarily, it's an opportunity to establish relationships. It's the only place in a given year that you can meet all of those principal players. I don't want to leave out, but there's also a good deal of focus on our public policy agenda, which, as you know, is critical to the bleeding disorders community this year, as the Congress tries to remake healthcare. A lot of people don't know what a critical role that our staff and volunteers play in planning the meeting. The actual planning curve is a 11 or 12 months to put on the annual meeting.
My name is Randy Curtis. I'm retired. I currently serve as the president of the Hemophilia Council of California, and I do a lot of speaking for the NHF at the annual meeting. I lead the adult men's sessions. When I was first diagnosed with hemophilia, it was 1955. My dad was stationed down in San Pedro in Southern California in the Army, and they noticed that I was having lots of bruising under my armpits, which they thought was odd. And they took me to the local hospital, which at this point in time, I believe Dr. Shelby Dietrich, who was a good friend of mine now, even though she's 90, diagnosed me with hemophilia.
What was treatment like at that time?
Ice and aspirin. So typically there would be a bleed and I'd be in pain and they would try and ice it down. And after a couple, 3 days, if it didn't resolve itself, I would have to go into the hospital and be in the hospital for a week getting plasma. So I spent most of my childhood, you know, let's say 25% of my childhood in the hospital through grade school. And so I had braces on my elbows, braces on my ankles, and I went to school in a wheelchair. The annual meeting is a great place to get information that you can take back to your chapter or you can use in your own life. You get to meet other people that are in the same boat as you are. Like, oh, look, that looks like a six-year-old kid with hemophilia. I have a six-year-old kid with hemophilia. There's these different activities that you can go on, and you can start bonding with these other people. And then you go into the sessions, and you hear the latest on, for example, gene therapy or some of these longer-acting products. And there's a great debate right now on whether you should use the longer-acting products to give fewer infusions or whether you should take the longer-acting products at the same rate that you've been taking them and just keep your level up higher. Those are kind of debates that you don't see at your local level, that you don't get to be involved with at the local level or while you're in your house. But to actually hear different people present these different sides of the argument and to get the, you know, basically see what the latest and greatest of healthcare is, particularly for folks that have fairly rare disorders, factor 10 deficiency, Glanzmann's, you know, folks that are maybe like 200 of them in the whole country, you can actually find some other people that have your same disorder and communicate and build your own little network of support.
And the Bloodstream Podcast is sponsored by
Shire.
Take two.
Okay.
And today's episode of the Bloodstream Podcast is sponsored by
Shire.
I think that's the one.
Thanks Shire. Hope you enjoyed that segment. Once again, if you want to see what Believe is up to at NHF's annual meeting, check out the program notes for the Believe at NHF 2017 video and schedule. All right, Natalie, only a couple minutes left here. Parting shots for episode 15. What's one thing you want to leave behind for the audience before we sign off?
One thing I want to leave behind. So after we're done recording this, we are going to Flywheel, which is kind of our new obsession.
That's true.
Individually and as a couple.
Yes.
And so my parting shot is exercise is more fun when you do it with someone.
Very cute little rhyming thing you just did off the top of your head.
I mean, it is.
I know. It is true. No, it is true.
Yes. I feel like this summer we've really both upped our fitness a lot. And it just feels good to like kind of make it part of our day and to know that we're doing it together. And doesn't hurt that like we have found convenient and fun class. So Flywheel's a cycling class, and in no way are they sponsoring this podcast. It'd be nice if they were.
Oh, we should talk to them about that.
All right, when we go down there, we will.
Yeah,
but yeah, good idea. It's I'm just excited to be on a healthy track with you.
Yeah, accountability goes a long way. There's a reason that people use it when they're trying to build a new habit or break an old one. And I agree. Yeah, it's been fun. It's more fun when you're doing something with a buddy.
Patrick, what's your parting shot?
My parting shot for this month is I haven't had the time to look into this yet, but I've seen a couple headlines about the benefits of cannabis tea for chronic illness and liver health. And I just in general am interested in how we are learning about the use of cannabis for medicinal purposes in a variety of ways. And I think the fact that this is suggesting that there's some potential benefits to your liver, which is something that's of specific interest in the hemophilia community. It's just interesting to me. So I haven't looked into it. Maybe if I do and I find it particularly compelling, it'll be a comment piece on a future episode, but for now, it's just kind of something that's out there you might want to take a look at. One article in particular, the title of it is Five Benefits of Cannabis Tea for Chronic Illness. There'll be a link in the program notes. So that's it. Just something that's kind of interesting.
Cool, yeah.
On the radar. On the radar.
Maybe we'll start brewing our own cannabis milk thistle tea and, you know.
That could be fun.
Yeah.
All right.
Stop by the Bloodstream booth to see if we have some. Just kidding.
Let's back it off a little bit there. Okay. All right.
Check it out.
Yeah. Check out the article. There'll be nothing at the booth but stickers. And that is all for episode 15 of the Bloodstream podcast. And Natalie and I will be back next month with another excellent episode. Don't forget to check out bloodstreammedia.com and to subscribe to the Ask the Expert Powering Through and Bloodline podcasts to hear all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community. Have a question for Ask the Expert or an idea for a future episode of Bloodstream? Email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on Facebook, facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, and on Twitter at bloodstreaminfo. This episode of Bloodstream was written by Patrick James Lynch and Natalie Lynch, produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Geelan, Rob Bradford, Andrew Gall, Josh Bragg, Ava Freeman, and Cole B. Crow, and the Bloodstream podcast is edited by Mr. Andrew Gall. Special thanks to everybody at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and Shire. Thanks as well to Tayan Chow Kudu, Val Bias, Christine Simpson, Matt Delaney, Susan Hartman, Randy Curtis, and Rebecca Berenson for contributing to this episode. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player of choice or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself.